I'm Maxine McHugh, and this is Talking Teaching. Hi there, and good to have your company again. Well, as we all race towards the end of another crowded year, let's take some time to listen to the reflections of someone who I think has been one of Australia's most significant educational leaders. In September, Professor Glyn Davis completed 14 years as Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne. In that time, he engineered transformative change with the Melbourne model of integrated undergraduate and graduate education. Melbourne's stature, both nationally and internationally, is undisputed. And in particular, the Graduate School of Education is ranked number one in Australia and number six globally. Glyn has rebuilt the university. New learning spaces are inviting places, and most important, there are more campus coffee shops or carts than you can count. It's a buzzy place, or as Glyn would say, a place of brilliant minds who care deeply about teaching, research, and engagement. One of the things of which he's most proud is that Melbourne now attracts students from right across the country. And from next year, there will be a further broadening of scholarships to enable entry for a more diverse cohort. A writer, a teacher, and a wide reader, Glyn Davis loves the contest of ideas and lively conversation about all manner of things. He cares deeply about the state of education, which is why I was keen to grab 30 or so minutes of his time before he left the campus to start the next phase of his professional life, possibly in philanthropy. So settle back and listen to Glyn Davis as he talks about leadership, the different ways that students are engaging with technology, and about the joy of teaching. Glyn, welcome to our final episode of Talking Teaching for the year.
Thank you, Maxine.
You made your formal exit as Vice-Chancellor of this university in September, and I must say I was struck by the farewell note that you sent to all staff. You chose to honour the teaching profession by a great quote from Robert Bolt's play, A Man for All Seasons. I'm wondering if you could tell us that and perhaps give us the context.
Sure, Maxine. There's a lovely scene in the play fairly early on where Sir Thomas More is counselling a young man about his future and his careers. And he urges him, be a teacher. You could be a great teacher. You could really get a lot out of this. And the young man is deeply sceptical. If I was, he said, who would know it? And Sir Thomas responds, well, you, your pupils, your friends, God, not a bad public, that. It's a lovely reminder that teachers matter.
It's a nice quote. And of course, you went on in that note, Glyn, to say, as teachers, we participate in the unbroken transmission of ideas and mission, renewal and discovery across generations. I thought really that conveys a great sense of purpose for teachers, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And who can teach without thinking about those who taught them and realising that they in turn learn from others? And so you really are part of a tradition. You're not just standing there by yourself. Around you are the people who taught you, and in front of you are people, many of whom will become teachers.
When you look back, who were the teachers who lit a spark in you, either way back in school or in early university days?
In school, I went to a parochial Catholic primary school, so I mainly remember the terror of the Sisters of St. Joseph, the Show No Mercy Nuns, as they were sometimes called. They certainly ran a disciplined class. And then I realised, looking back, they had 50 or more young people in their classrooms.
It was crowd control, wasn't it?
Crowd control and of a level of discipline just to keep the place sane. I don't envy them. I can't imagine what that was like, because you can't see it as a small child, except you get a sense that this is just occasionally veering toward running out of control. And then to a high school that was of mixed quality teaching. I think one of the things we often forget is how much the training has improved over the last generation and how better supported teachers are now than they were a generation earlier. Doesn't mean there weren't lots of outstanding individuals, but they weren't necessarily working in the right context. And I think there's been measurable improvement, and we should be really proud of that. But yes, like everybody else, I had a couple of favourite teachers who really encouraged me, and one of whom, after a class once, sketched out for me how you went to university. I went to a school where very few people went to university, and it wasn't at all clear to me how you did it, and I didn't know anyone growing up who'd been to university, so it wasn't like there were people to ask. And he stayed behind and said, "You seem interested, and let me tell you how you do this." And he actually walked me through the steps, which was remarkably helpful.
So you didn't have a family that was putting university on the map for you?
Oh, I had a family who were incredibly supportive of whatever I and my brothers chose to do. But my parents had both worked in journalism. That was their profession, and that wasn't then a university-based profession. On the contrary, you left school early, you went in as a copy boy, you got a cadetship if you were lucky, and you rose through. It was a traditional traineeship model, and that was certainly my father's experience. And my mother had worked around some of the same areas, though not with the same formal training. So, no, we didn't, as a family, know people who went to university. We didn't live in a suburb full of graduates, although I'm sure there were some, I just didn't know who they were. And in truth, other than visits to the doctor, you didn't, and the dentist, I guess, you didn't actually encounter people as a child who had university education. None of the teachers were university educated. They had mainly been to teachers' college, but certainly in the parochial schools, that might not even have done that if it had come through a religious order. So yes, they had training of their own sort and important training, but not the training that I became familiar with later on as a university person.
So how did you come to choose your subjects, for instance, in your undergraduate degree? What were the influences there?
I guess I had assumed I would follow the family tradition and be a journalist. And by that stage, people were starting to go to university and onto newspapers in particular. Not just my father, but my grandfather had been a journalist. So this was deeply part of our family. And that meant we were interested in politics and interested in literature. And they were essentially the choices I made. And at the end of my honours year, I had the great pleasure of being supervised by Donald Horn, who was a great honours supervisor. I applied for a graduate cadetship at the Sydney Morning Herald. And as a backup, in case I didn't get it, I applied for a Commonwealth scholarship to do a PhD at the Australian National University. As it turned out, I got both and had a long, dark night of the soul trying to work out which was the right choice for me. And for various reasons, I went with the scholarship and the PhD.
You mentioned there Donald Horn, of course, the late writer, author of the iconic Lucky Country, and a public intellectual.
Very much so.
I'm just wondering, did he influence you in terms of the way your career has developed, not just as an academic, but as very much someone who engages publicly with ideas?
I guess it did. I can't point to particular traces except to say he was very much encouraging of the idea that you should speak and that Australia should be a place of lively debate. And particularly in his autobiographies, and he wrote many, he told almost all parts of his story at some point. Those were books about ideas and people and discussions, and they gave you a sense of a life of the mind and what it would mean. And they also said, importantly, that it was possible in this country. For many of us growing up, every idea seemed to come from somewhere else and every discussion belonged to some other nation. And there was a sort of presumption that there wasn't much of value here necessarily. And Donald Horn pushed hard against that, not just in his own right, but by showing that other people also had ideas and arguments and that you could be part of this milieu, even from Australia.
He was also a most interesting teacher, and to come back to teaching, that's something you have continued to do as Vice-Chancellor, both initially at Griffith University and certainly at the University of Melbourne. What's been the buzz of teaching for you?
Well, who doesn't love teaching? Who doesn't love sharing ideas and having the conversation with people? And my idea of great teaching is conversation. We can all give lectures, but they're much less interesting than seminars and conversations and tutorials because it's the back and forth that makes it really interesting. And we all learn so much when we teach. So the other great part of it is it's very much everybody walks out enriched. If it's been a great class, you've learned something from the people in front of you. They've challenged you. You've put some ideas in front of them, and some of them they've bought. Some of them you can see the skepticism on the face, and you have to go back and think, well, either did I get that wrong in how I explained it, or maybe it isn't such a good way of framing the problem. And that's just so rewarding.
In terms of educating the next generation of teachers, I mean, whether it's for universities, for schools, for early learning centres, what should universities focus on, do you think?
This is the perennial question, and it goes, of course, to how we frame the teaching. So here at Melbourne, we made a very conscious decision more than a decade ago to move to a graduate model for education. We basically said education is a profession like other professions, and you need a broad grounding in the arts and science before you even start. And that's a luxury in a sense, because it means you're taking in people who've already got majors in some of the things they're going to teach in schools, and you can spend a lot of time thinking about pedagogy, thinking about technique, thinking about clinical applications of teaching, because you don't have to also be trying to teach them the substantive work that's going to inform their daily practice. And that's important. I was very keen on this model. It was pioneered by the Melbourne Graduate School of Education, then called the Faculty of Education, by the Dean, Field Rickard, but also by the professoriate and beyond inside the faculty. It wasn't a single person. It was a very determined group of people who wanted to do teaching better. And what a joy to fall in behind them and support them and help make it happen.
Whether it's that model or others pursued by different universities, though, do you think we are looking at an enhanced status, enhanced training inevitably for teachers?
I expect that's the way the conversation is going. Much of the discussion to date is more punitive than supportive. It's all about implying that there are people teaching who shouldn't be, or teaching, getting into teaching courses who shouldn't, and punishing them for being there, or imposing additional benchmarks before they're allowed to teach. Now, there may be a role for that, but it strikes me that it's probably symptomatic rather than going to something more profound. Of course, the best people should go to teaching. And if the best people are going to go to teaching, you have to reward that financially. You have to reward it in prestige. You have to give them a career that makes it worthwhile staying in the classroom. Other places manage to do this really well. It's the tradition in other nations to see this as amongst the most honourable positions possible. Why not here?
Indeed. I'd like to move our discussion now to that of students. And I know you've not been a direct participant, say, in the schools debate of the past decade, but I'm interested in your observations about Australian student performance. And as you know, as measured by PISA and PIRLS, we have been in decline over the past decade. How confident are you we can reverse this?
There are experts on PISA scores, I'm not one of them, who do argue that what we're seeing is a shift in comparative rankings rather than absolute decline. That is, some other countries are really improving and overtaking us. And so it may be that our position isn't quite as poor as it looks. There's also, I understand, evidence that the differentials between city, outer metro and regional are really profound, and that if you draw a line basically within city boundaries in Australia, you get PISA scores that are as good as most in the world. And it's the aggregate scores that come through, which tells us that our focus and our resources are probably not going where they're needed, which is clearly out of metro and into the regions. And that might be where the investment is needed. It seems to me that these are addressable problems. If we can do very well in the cities, we can do very well everywhere. So we have to work out what it is we're not doing in other places and how we can address them. So I think both in absolute terms but also in comparative terms, yes, we could lift our scores. I don't think this is an inevitable decline. But we need to work out what does the evidence tell us, and then what are the actions required to address that.
Let's talk about the ways that students are learning these days, because you've been saying some very interesting things about this. Your thoughts on how students are learning, particularly with the use of technology?
Well, I can only talk about universities, and so it's quite a different setting in schools. But I've always been fascinated to watch how students use the technology. And you can do that in university because students hang around in the corridors and in the rooms and in the libraries in particular.
And the coffee shops.
And the coffee shops. And you can just wander through and look at how they're doing things. And I this first caught my eye when people were moaning falling attendance at lectures. And that's true. Less and less people go to lectures. And yet, all of our data told us, because we've got wireless, how many people are logged onto the wireless, so we know how many people are on campus at any one time. Less people going to lectures, more people were coming to campus. How do we reconcile this? Well, in part, they're coming to campus to use the wireless, of course, because it's so very good. And it's been good for a long time. Pre-NBN, it was sort of world standard. And if you watch students watch lectures online, they behave completely differently. I've seen people go through a lecture at double speed or 1.5 times speed and mark the passages they want to come back to. And then they've come back and they've gone over and over a particular passage or problem that they want to understand. So they've used the rewind function. They've fast-forwarded, come back, fast-forward, come back, and taken detailed notes on the parts of the lecture that speak to the things they want to get from them. In that way, they're actually more intensively using the resource than they could if they were in the lecture theatre.
And they're probably doing that with some friends and discussing parts of it as well, so they're working collaboratively.
Common. Yep, you often see three or four people clustered around the same computer arguing about what it is they're seeing on the screen. You can't do that in a classroom. So we should be a bit careful about jumping to conclusions that it's necessarily a bad thing that people don't want to be in the lecture theatre necessarily.
What's it mean for all those wonderful lecture theatres that you've built, though?
Well, we stopped building them here for quite some time ago for that very reason. All the new teaching spaces, as you know, Maxine, are all designed around seminars, small teaching spaces, small groups, because that's how people use them. You use big lecture theatres often for first-year lectures where people are learning their way in, but also for public events where you do need a big space. But less and less are we using them as the core delivery mechanism for major teaching.
I think there probably is an interesting link here with schools, and that is perhaps preparing students for precisely this kind of learning that you've described. Does that then lead to, we've got a bit of a binary argument about this at the moment, but this question of whether you're teaching for content at schools or more for the development of critical thinking skills?
And of course you're doing both all the time, and that's, in a sense, it's by interrogating content that you teach critical thinking. And so the most interesting classes are the one where you take an apparently uncontroversial fact and then you unpick it and try and get behind it and understand why people might discuss an issue in this way and what the alternatives are. And by the time you've finished, you've often got a really great sense that actually this is not as simple as it seemed and not as straightforward as it seemed, and there are legitimate contending views on this question, at which point you've taught the content really effectively, but no one's missed the underlying lesson, which is about how to think about a problem.
You've also written extensively about the need for much greater choice for our post-secondary students when it comes to universities or whatever. Realistically, what do you think the future landscape will be looking like for tertiary students in Australia? Are we going to see more of the specialist universities that you've talked about, perhaps micro-credentialing?
I think micro-credentialing is with us now, so it's clearly going to be part of the future. That means a whole lot of other players can dive into this, but we shouldn't forget that brand matters and that people do want to be associated with a great institution, university, college, school, otherwise. So they aren't necessarily just going to go onto the web and pick the cheapest product and grab it. It's not how they behave in other areas. It won't be how they behave with education necessarily. What I worry about is Australia has, over the last generation, created very large institutions and only very large institutions. If you want to go to university in Australia, you're going to a large university. That's just how it is.
And we keep duplicating.
We keep duplicating, and we haven't created any new institutions for 25 years. And one of the interesting questions, are we just going to go on growing as we grow as a nation? Or does there come a time in which we say, as they did in the 1960s in Australia, it's time to consciously create some new and different institutions rather than just replicate what we have? We've been very reluctant to do that. It's more expensive than just funding at the margins, new places in existing universities. But there comes a point at which we're going to need that diversity. We're also going to need specialist institutions in a way that are very hard to sustain in big places at the moment. If you want to learn acting in this country, and there are fine actors, there are a handful of schools that do a fabulous job. They all have to be cross-subsidised from somewhere else because the funding rate makes it very difficult. But if we're going to produce those sorts of skills in a whole range of other areas of highly specialised knowledge, we really do need to think about, have we got the institutional framework right to do that?
Has that been the biggest public policy disappointment for you during this period, that in fact successive governments have really turned their backs on this?
Well, yes, I'd frame it slightly differently. I'd say the disappointment for me is that there are relatively simple ways available to government to open up the system. They go to funding rates, they go to accreditation. There's a range of instruments that are open and nobody's got any interest in using them. And so we haven't seen the experimentation and the encouragement of diversity. We've had brief moments. We were able to introduce the Melbourne model because then Minister Julie Bishop signaled that she would like institutions to try things. You know, she was looking for experimentation. We came with a proposal about how to do that, one that cost the Commonwealth nothing, I should say, required permission rather than money. She was very generous in her support of that and we were able to make, I think, a significant difference. But those moments are very rare, and it's hard to point to another one since. And it's not that we haven't had foreign ministers necessarily, it's just that all of the institutional pressures are toward conformity, toward a single model, and away from the idea that diversity might inherently be worthwhile.
Let me turn to the issue of leadership again, something that you've written extensively about. And it's an issue we keep returning to on this podcast, whether, again, it's a school or a university. To be an educational leader requires quite specific skills. So, Glenn, what have you learned about what's required of educational leaders?
Look, it's a great question, not an easy one to answer, because it's hard to separate your own experience from in a sense, what a more sustained look at the evidence might mean. The education leaders I've admired have all led by example, so they have actually been in the classroom. They've shown that they can do what they ask others to do. And I think, while technically not necessary, I think it is actually important for motivation. I think a principal who isn't themselves a skilled teacher struggles to carry the credibility with other teachers when they want to talk about pedagogy, when they want to improve standards. If it sounds like do as I say, not as I do, why would anyone follow you? So you need some credibility in the leader. And every now and again, governments or governing councils mutter about, well, it would be good to get business skills in leading universities or something. They miss the point about the activity and what it is we do in institutions. The same is true in schools. So that's the first thing. I think you do actually need source credibility. It actually matters. And the second is that it's about the team that then leads. It isn't the person. It isn't the leader. It's the team. And really clever leaders know what they're good at and what they're not good at, and they build a team around it so that the portfolio of skills is superb, even if no one is an expert of everything. And that's so important, whereas poor leaders pick people like themselves. And so the team is narrow and it's got no diversity and there's no argument because it's full of people who are similar. So the most impressive leadership teams in any education institution, school, or university I've seen have been lively and argumentative, because that's actually how you lead well. And then there's a third characteristic which I might frame as tolerance, though it's probably better thought of as encouragement. Really good leaders are willing to try and fail and willing to let others, more importantly, try and fail. And so the great schools are the ones where a teacher does have an idea for how we could do something differently, pitches it, gets support, tries it. And in a sense, the lessons are then shared across the school. And if it succeeds, brilliant. And if it doesn't, well, we learn something anyway about how this school community operates. So I've been hugely impressed by this. A lot of leadership is actually about encouraging others. It's not about the leader. The best natural leader I ever saw was in my son's cricket team. He was the coach. He was a middle-ranking public servant out of the transport department. And it wasn't, to be honest, one of the world's great cricket teams. They struggled to get a team. It was a mixed team. There were girls and boys, but most of the teams they played were just all-boy teams. And it would be fair to say that the skills weren't as highly developed as they could be. And I watched this man encourage this team. He found something to praise for everybody in the team. He made them learn how to praise each other when they did well and how to console each other when they made mistakes. He made them all heroes. He told big stories about each of them, so they felt really proud of what they had done. And this isn't like a Hollywood film. They didn't go on to win the series or anything. They did go on to perform better than they would have on the sort of basis of their natural talents. But they did feel so engaged with what they were doing. They were so excited. They wanted to be at cricket practice. They wanted to play on Saturdays. And I watched from the sidelines as one parent amongst many and thought, there's an awful lot to learn from this man. Very small setting, but it stayed with me very firmly.
One other thing I do want to ask you about, and that is that leaders often need to be big change makers, sometimes to really, really, you know, upend the system. And you did that here at the University of Melbourne. We have school principals in the system who often have to go into a very dysfunctional school,
yep,
and do some things that make them really unpopular for 12 months or so. What's that like? I mean, you must have had some moments there where you knew people were chattering about you and all the rest of it, and that can't have been pleasant. How do leaders navigate their way through that?
Well, the first thing on the chatter about you is it doesn't matter as long as you don't listen to it, as long as you don't hear it.
Ignore the gossip, you mean?
If anyone tries to tell you the gossip, you have to say, I don't want to know, I can't know, and don't tell me. It's better that you don't know what people are saying about you than that you try and respond to it, because that actually starts changing your behaviour. But I think the fundamental thing about change is it works when you've brought the community together, agreed the change is necessary, even if it's not popular, and you can remind people that this is a shared journey all the way through. And yes, there are people who don't like it and who quit and or who criticise, but if you don't start with the credibility that says, we discussed this, we agreed the problems, we know where we're going, we know why we're doing this, then you've got no pathway. And in what often happens is people announce very large changes. They come in, they do a survey, they bring some consultants in, they announce a very large change, and they discover that it falls over because the journey doesn't carry people and they resist or they just pay no attention. To work, a change has to involve everybody. It has to be agreed, even if it's not welcomed, as it were. It has to be understood, and you can't communicate too much along the journey about what we're doing, why we're doing it. Remember that we agreed this, and then this is how it's going to look when it's done. Celebrating the changes so that you actually acknowledge them along the way, the markers. Telling people when it's over is a really important one. Now, this is the new normal. This is the new state we've got here. Now we make this work so that people feel that they're on a journey and that they're part of what it is you're doing.
You make that sound so easy.
No, it's not easy for anybody.
But still, there must have been moments for you.
Sure.
When you thought, I've really got to hold my mettle here.
Yeah. And then that's one of the tests of leadership. Can you be firm, clear, calm? Can you walk through this, carry people, instill confidence that the journey is worth doing and can be done, and not look like you're panicking? The moment you panic as leader, you've sort of licensed everybody to run away. So it is just part of the skills. There's a degree of acting involved.
Glenn, just a couple of final points. It's also been important to you in your time as Vice-Chancellor for you to maintain your own scholarly and research interests. Has that been really quite sustaining for you, you know, in what has been a difficult administrative job?
Sure. It's a bit like teaching. If you can research, why wouldn't you? It's such an enjoyable thing to do, to actually do original research and to write about it. But it also goes to the credibility point. If you're going to ask your colleagues to work very hard on difficult projects around research and teaching, you lead by example. If you don't research, you cannot really clearly ask others to get involved. If you don't teach, how can you claim, you know, to know what happens in the classroom, to have a sense of what it's like to be in front of a class? I mean, one of the confronting things about walking now into any university lecture, when we do a traditional lecture, is you're staring at people with laptops open and you can just see the back of the laptop with the Apple symbol and you're talking to them rather than to the faces, which you can dimly see behind them, and you have no idea whether they're watching you or whether they're, you know, chatting with each other on social media. The point being that if you haven't been in a classroom recently, you don't have that sense, and then you've got to work out what are ways of engaging people around that enormous constraint. It's actually quite confronting, but it's an important reminder that the world has changed.
You've also been writing. I know you're a voracious reader. Perhaps we can end actually on reading, because I love this quote from Barack Obama when he left the White House. The New York Times interviewed him about his reading. And of course, he said that that was so critical to him because it gave him time to actually slow down, to get a sense of perspective. And of course, what he says he got from writers, from historians, was that sense of the complexity of the human condition. I imagine you relate to that.
Very much so. Reading is how you work out what other minds make of the same issues you're grappling with. And it's how you get into fields you don't know enough about, but someone else has thought a lot of time thinking about. Or it's how you get enthused about knowledge and what it can be. We have the great privilege here at Melbourne of working with our colleague Peter McPhee, a historian of the French Revolution. And again, I've watched Peter just get large rooms excited about what we can learn about the dynamics of politics from the example of the French Revolution, the interplay of biography, historical circumstances, economics, and international relations all coming to bear on a particular moment or decision or place. And Peter specializes in taking small towns outside Paris and asking, what did the revolution mean here? How did it change lives? you can't go through that without retaining a lifelong interest in the revolution or without wanting to pick up Peter's book.
And yourself?
I'm very interested in contemporary fiction, and I try to read widely, and I've been trying in the last few years to read predominantly women because you want to hear voices outside your own experience and you want to see how the world looks to others. And so that's been really enjoyable.
And actually Australian female fiction is very rich, isn't it? Lots of wonderful writers coming to the fore.
Absolutely. I've just finished reading Pat Barker's The Silence of the Girls, which is her retelling of, I guess, the end of the Iliad from the perspective of a captive woman in the Greek camp, a Trojan woman, Briseis, in the Greek camp. And it's a really imaginative retelling of a story that, whereas the Iliad is heroic and extraordinary, she's telling about what life is like, not on the front line, which is all the epic tells, but what it's like behind the scenes, as it were, the harshness of the treatment of the women, the lottery about who thrives and who doesn't. It's a very interesting take on a familiar story, and you know, sort of brilliant to see it done that way.
Well, see, you've got a lot of travelling coming up. What's on your list?
So over the summer, I've got some interesting new poetry to read. David Malouf has a new book out, which I'm really excited about. I'll read anything by David Malouf.
He's also written about the Trojan Wars in
Ransom. He has
Ransom,
which is one of his great books, and as it turns out, might be his last novel because of some story saying that he's not going to write another one. But it is a brilliant novel to finish on, if that's the one he's going to do. And it has a remarkable meditation in the middle about what it means to be an authority figure and how an authority figure is there for other people, not for themselves, and how Priam is the person he's talking about, has to appear to be unchanging because that's what people want. They want stability in their lives and they want this authority figure never to shift. And even though he's now old and infirm, they don't see that because all they see is what they expect to see, not actually what's there. It's a stunningly good book.
Glyn, this has been so enjoyable.
Thank you, Maxine.
We know you're going to continue to be seen on campus. We certainly hope so. But look, in all your endeavours over the next couple of years, we wish you all good things. So thanks for being part of Talking Teaching with us.
And thank you. And congratulations on building this fabulous podcast, because this is a great audience you're bringing together and you're encouraging a conversation we need to have.
And just a postscript. Glyn will be continuing to teach classes in one of his new roles as Professor of Political Science at the Crawford School of Public Policy at the ANU. Well, that's it from the Talking Teaching team this year. Thanks so much to all of you for tuning in and for your feedback. We'll be back in February with lots of stories about what's going on in the classroom and in education generally. Thanks as well to Gavin Naber, our sound engineer and composer of the musical theme that opens and closes this podcast. Thanks as well to the Melbourne Graduate School of Education and its army of splendid experts whose work does so much to inform this podcast. And a final thanks to the Ramsey Foundation for their generous support. It's much appreciated. Bye for now and have a great summer break.